At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
And I turn on the television set, and it's not at the beginning of the movie. It's somewhere in one of the scenes where it's a news scene and they're broadcasting news. And I thought it was real. I lost my mind. I mean, I'm like the first or second time I'm left home alone, and now we're going to war.
This is Cold War Conversations.
Thanks to Patreon supporter Jim Black for providing our intro today. Over the past nearly two decades, the Stuck in the 80s podcast has emerged as the go-to for all aspects of 1980s nostalgia from a North American point of view. And much like Cold War Conversations, Stuck in the 80s is an award-winning podcast. Recognizing that decade's popular culture was heavily influenced by the Cold War, co-host Peter Ryan organized a discussion with its curators Steve Spears and Brad Williams. During their chat, Brad and Steve expressed their views on the extent to which Cold War elements permeated all aspects of our daily lives through that decade. And this special edition of Cold War Conversations will also feature a playlist on Spotify, so do check that out in the episode notes. It features many of the songs discussed during this lively episode. And we thank Brad and Steve for the chance to organise a cross-podcast discussion today and encourage listeners to visit their website, sit80s.com, to learn more about their dedication to keeping the nostalgia of the 80s alive. Now, can you help me to continue producing the podcast? Single or monthly donations really help me to keep the podcast on the air.
Hi, my name's Glenn. I'm from New Zealand. I've always been fascinated by Cold War. This podcast just brings it all back to life, and Ian does such a good job of this. And that's why I support him on the Patreon.
If you're interested in helping, supporting me, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Peter Ryan, Steve Spears, and Brad Williams to our Cold War conversation.
So, back in 2005, podcasting was still a new thing. No one was really trying it. And I was working at a newspaper in St. Petersburg, Florida, and we wanted to get into it. And so I pitched the idea of doing one on 80s pop culture. And I honest to God, thought it would maybe last 20 or 30 episodes at the most. I think even when we hit our 25th anniversary, I mean, when we hit our 25th podcast, our 25th episode, we even celebrated that as a big milestone because we didn't even think we'd go that far. But we found out that other people were listening, and over the years it's grown to become a weekly show that's featured interviews with, you know, 100, 200 different icons from the 80s. But we also tackle topics like, you know, best cover songs of 80s songs, you know, favorite movies from 1985, stuff like that. And it has evolved and lasted and grown. And now this year, this month, actually, we just celebrated our 15th anniversary.
Congratulations. That's great. And a real legacy, as you say, when you started out, podcasting was only just really getting going, and to have lasted 15 years and to be able to have done how many shows now did you say, Steve?
563.
My goodness. That's just fantastic. Well, once again, congratulations. And, you know, we're here to talk a little bit about the Cold War and the impact that the Cold War had on the 1980s, or maybe the impact that the 1980s had on the Cold War. And I actually took a little time yesterday in preparation for the discussion that we're having now to go back all the way back to 2005. I think it was episode 16 where, Steve, you and a couple of co-hosts at the time discussed politics in the 1980s. And I remember Ronald Reagan was a big feature of the discussion, elements about Gorbachev and some of the shifts that were going on in the 1980s and so forth. So, you know, with that in context and the context of politics as a backdrop, I want to bring it down to the human level and to ask both of you guys, if you can talk a little bit about, as individuals that grew up and were in high school and university during the Cold War, to what extent was this discussed as a topic, Cold War issues or the impact of the Cold War when you were in school, whether in high school and university, thinking that, that this really was at the outset of the 80s and the Cold War was a feature in pretty well everything that we were doing back then?
Go ahead, Brad.
Peter, I think it was just something that was kind of ever present. It was, you know, something that was, you know, the threat of the Russians, if you will, was kind of everywhere. And it's funny when you say that, what I think about in school is I think about some of the things we read in English class. Like that was where, you know, some of the propaganda came in. Like I remember reading a book, I don't know if you've heard of the book, Alast Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is just, thinking back on it, it's just such a sunshiny, like, we can get through this nuclear war thing in our little small town. It's almost pandering. But that's what kind of leaps to mind. But yeah, it's definitely something that was, you know, we were soaking in it, right? It was part of the landscape.
I don't remember it so much in school being a topic. To me, I think I learned it all from music and movies. In college, I actually went and took a course in Soviet Union history, and it was easily one of the hardest classes I ever took. If I regret anything in college, I don't regret much, but I regret taking that course. That was just ridiculously impossible. But that's how I absorbed it. I absorbed it through popular culture.
That's interesting. And talking about popular culture and the manner in which the Cold War influenced popular culture over the course of the 1980s, what would you both say were some of the key cultural facets in terms of how the Cold War was presented from an American perspective?
I think that it took on the same specter as Nazi Germany did years before or decades before. Communism was an absolute bad. The United States was an absolute good, and there was really nowhere in between. And I think that came to us, like I said, in the form of the popular culture. You had movie villains, you know, Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, an absolute villain from beginning to end. The Russians and the Cubans in Red Dawn, absolute villains, you know, for most of the movie. I think that's how it happened. In music, it was a little different. I think in the 80s, we saw this transition from singing about Vietnam to singing more about the Russians and the Americans. But in movies, it was just you were right or you were wrong.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you know, you, at least in my high school in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, seeing someone walking the halls with a Kill a Commie for Mommy t-shirt was like, you wouldn't even blink. Like, of course. Yeah, that would be a lovely Mother's Day present.
I wasn't expecting that, Brad, but that's a very good example. No, but I think that speaks a lot to some of the polarization that we saw during the 1980s, whether it was in the States or in Canada where I grew up or in Western Europe. There was very much, I think, Steve, as you mentioned, it was very black or white. You were on one side or you were on the other. There was really no point where the two elements were going to intersect. And I think that also speaks to some of the personalities that we saw in the 1980s. And, you know, when you think about the political sphere in the 1970s, I think that there was very much an era of consensus. There was a lot of treaties that were laid out between the West and the East, attempts to try and break down some barriers. But it almost was like ratcheted up when you think about when we went from December 31st, 1979 to January 1st, 1980. And with that in mind, from the studying that you guys have done or from the individuals that you might have looked at or followed or even interviewed on the Stuck in the 80s podcast, who would you identify as probably the most important personalities related to the Cold War between 1980 and 89? And by the way, this isn't just political. This could be in the realm of entertainment, in business and technology, anything that comes to mind.
Well, I mean, to start with, you mentioned politics, and I think that's you know, that's the top of the ziggurat. So I'll take the easy answer and make Steve, you know, dig for harder ones. But Reagan and Gorbachev, I mean, Ronald Reagan and the, you know, the Peacekeeper missile program and the SDI initiative and just putting, you know, ratcheting up the pressure on Russia. That was, you know, that is the big note, simple answer for, you know, that is losing you listeners as I say things that they already know. But I mean, that's the obvious answer. I think you can dig deeper into, you know, as Steve said, I think you have maybe some more nuance in the music world.
I think with Reagan, it wasn't so much him as a person. It was him as a cartoon or a symbol. I mean, the whole yippee-ki-yay cowboy image of Americans was personified in Reagan. And I think people to this day, the people who still idolize him, they idolize that the myth.
That image. That image. Right.
Yeah, it's an image thing. I think what happened at the end of the 70s is you transition from a president like Carter, who was well-spoken, well-meaning, but in a really tough spot, to someone who was more bravado than brains. And that's what America wanted right then. And so he became, you know, the father figure of America. But if you go outside, and this is where I think it gets interesting, as the 80s continue and my education in the Cold War continues, and it continues through, like I said, music and movies, you start hearing songs and you start hearing the other side, and you start getting these voices who question who's the good guy and who's the bad guy really. Like, and I think that's where things start to become a little bit more interesting in the 80s. And I mean, I didn't read the New York Times in the 80s. I read the St. Petersburg Times, but I did listen to Sting and I did listen to Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And you too. And they had a message for me too about the Cold War. And so that's where the education, that's where those personalities start to form. And you start to see these people on different sides of a multifaceted problem, not just a right versus wrong.
And I think that that's a really interesting answer. And Steve, you alluded there to music. And when I think about the 1980s, for me personally, if someone was to ask me what were my biggest influences from that period, it would have to be music. And I certainly would agree that there was a lot of music that was produced over the course of the 80s that focused on the Cold War and really, I think, drove home different messages. I was just curious in terms of what you guys have seen, you know, whether it was during the time or since the 1980s, if you can give us some thoughts about what were some of the key themes that were being produced musically that artists were trying to convey over that period.
I think the message was, you've got to look a little deeper, and you get songs like Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Land of Confusion by Genesis, 99 Luft Balloons by Nana, you know, 2 Minutes to Midnight by Iron Maiden. Russians by Sting, I think, is still one of the first songs where he takes the view that the other side are just as human as we are. You know, they have families, they have children. You know, right. I hope the Russians love their children too. I think that was those were the first times where we started to listen to people saying, You're simplifying this way too much, and you need to put a lot more thought into it.
Which of the songs, because you mentioned a few of them there, I'd be curious, maybe Brad, I'd love to get your views on this. Which musical efforts were the most successful in terms of being able to convey that idea about you need to think more about this? This is profound, and it's something that could impact all of humanity if it goes the wrong way.
Well, it's funny. I'm going to answer kind of a different question. You know, Steve said it made us look a little deeper, but I think a lot of the music was just flat out cynical and, you know, we are going to blow ourselves up. And perhaps the unsaid message there is we're going to blow ourselves up unless we step back. But, you know, I think about Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself by Oingo Boingo. You know, we've come such a long, long way. We're civilized, except when it comes to the simple fact of living together. I think there is a lot of cynicism in music as well. And maybe that's anger.
You know, but I think of a song like Leningrad by Billy Joel, who another song that puts a human face on Russia. For every Two Tribes, which I agree with Brad, it's all about you know, the world's ending tomorrow, so let's go hit the clubs tonight kind of feel.
Yeah.
There's a Leningrad. So,
and for every Leningrad, there's the future so bright, I gotta wear shades.
Yeah, there's that song too. So it's you know, the messages are there. You just have to be willing to listen to them.
And I think listenability is a really big issue when it comes to music, and to be able to convey the message of a song, the theme of it, and really the emotion of it. And that leads me to another question around music. When we're talking about some of these songs, that I think, you know, Leningrad's a great example, the Russians, you know, Two Tribes, these all come to mind as elements that I would have on my Spotify playlist when it comes to Cold War music. Do you guys have any examples of songs that you think particularly impacted the general population, whether it was in the U.S. or in Western Europe, that really impacted people the most and got a sense across to them that we were really dealing with a very precarious period of history?
I think that – I'm going to answer this question in a slightly different way. I think that – most of the songs that I admire from that time that address the Cold War situation are actually done by European bands from several different genres. And I don't know if that's because they felt they were in the middle of a no-win battle between the US and Russia, or I don't know if that was just the music I was listening to then. I had transitioned by the middle of the 80s from American music to the more new wave sound. So those are the songs that appeal to me on that level. So the Frankie Goes to Hollywood's, you know, and the U2 and the Police and Sting and stuff like that. Even Iron Maiden is interesting to put the throw into the mix.
Yeah, I would put the Fixed Red Skies in there as well. But it's funny, Steve, I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. Most of that music is from European artists who were, you know, the unfortunate meat in the Cold War sandwich there. I can't think of a single country Western Cold War, you know, nuclear dread song. This wasn't in their vocabulary, I don't think.
But if you even look at, if you look at even the most obvious bands from America at that time, so you look at a Bruce Springsteen or John Cougar Mellencamp,
Styx or a 38 Special.
Styx and 38 Special never recorded a political song in their lives, really.
Well, that's kind of where I was going. Those are good time bands. Springsteen, not so much. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Springsteen and John Cougar Mellencamp, I don't think they had, I think they were still holding on to Vietnam at that point. I mean, Born in the USA is a song about Vietnam. It's not a song. I mean, what you could say that's part of the Cold War. But when I think of the Cold War, I think the thing that comes to my mind is U.S. and Russia.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, those two artists are, you know, not to just stereotype the hell out of them, but I will anyway. You know, they're singing about problems that are closer to you, right? They're not singing about problems about a missile coming from, you know, 8,000 miles away. They're singing about, you know, I lost my job and things are bad and, you know, I'm sad.
It's interesting because I saw something that was written up about the most influential songs country by country. And I would actually very much agree that the European music was, I think, much more profound and closer to the bone, because really, we weren't talking about a missile war in the sense of, like, it could have been an infantry war with the East Bloc coming over into the West. And it was that close. Anyway, somebody had told me that in Germany, the most influential Cold War song as it related to people who grew up in the era was, in fact, Nena's 99 Luftballons. And I get that. I mean, it was a catchy song, very popular, but it really had a message that a lot of people related to because they were living it in the actual fact.
I don't know how popular a Cold War artist would have been among American music, too. That's something to think about. We were so ridiculously over the top with our patriotism during that decade that I don't think there would have been much acceptance of Nena if she were American.
Yeah, not as much room for that kind of thinking or discourse.
They wouldn't have captured the attention of – I mean – music is still a business in the United States, or it certainly was then. I don't think there was any room in that business for a cynical artist singing about, you know, maybe we should reconsider our positions on nuclear war.
Yeah, probably not. Because I do remember that was exactly the era of Lee Greenwood and some of the more patriotic music that was coming out at the time that did exceptionally well in the United States.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked a little bit about music in the Cold War, and thanks, this has been really, really interesting thus far. I'd like to move over to cinema and talk a little bit about the Cold War when it came to the production of movies, particularly out of Hollywood. And when I think back to the era and when I take a look at what's on my watch list on Amazon or my list on Netflix, there's a lot of movies from the time, particularly that had anti-Soviet Union themes that in many ways I think were designed to whip up audiences and to develop a fervor in terms of what the storyline was going to take on. From the standpoint of movies that were produced in Hollywood during the 1980s that had Cold War themes to them, what do you guys feel were the objectives of these movies? Was it to promote patriotism, or was it to try and subtly get across another message?
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, we may be giving Hollywood too much credit if we're assigning, you know, too much thought to their perspectives other than what's going to do well at the box office. And I mean, in a lot of cases, I think it boils down to we need a villain for this story. Let's look at the shelf of villains. Well, the Vietnamese, not so much. Martians, we did that last year. Russians, yeah, okay, well, we can use that. That's something that, you know, that's a kind of a known pillar you can build a story around. I mean, you've got, you know, when you say Cold War movies, I think people go right to, Red Dawn and Rocky IV. But don't forget, there are comedies that are basically Cold War movies. Spies Like Us is a Cold War story. It's a incredibly stupid Cold War movie. Yeah, that's a good point. Stripes is a Cold War movie too.
Top Secret, that was a Cold War movie as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just I don't want to be too glib there, but I think it's just a easy tool for them to grab out of the story box.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases.
I have to say, I think back, one of my favorite Cold War films was the 1983 classic War Games. And there was very much, forgetting the computer graphics, which at the time I think we can all agree were phenomenal. And, you know, I still get chills when I watch the movie at home and they walk into that big NORAD command center and you think to yourself, like back when I was 11 years old or 12 years old, this was just the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And I want to get into IT. I want to work with computers. But the whole movie was based around the concept of there is no winner. Nobody's going to get out of this thing alive. And I remember the very final scene was the object of the game was not to play, the whole tic-tac-toe thing at the end. And it was one of those things, I think, when you go back and you think about how that movie played out and the message it tried to get across to people of all ages, there was an element of profoundness to it. But I think that that was probably more the exception as opposed to the rule.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say that if you look at even Red Dawn, there's a scene at the end where they're limping away, they're shot, they're probably going to die somewhere within the next mile. And instead of gunning them down, the Cuban commander just basically says, you know, go. You know, he softens and goes. At the end of Rocky IV, he turns the crowd around. So I think that it's there. I mean, there are the messages are there, that they're just not. It's not what we remember so much. What do you remember about Red Dawn? You remember him standing on a mountaintop yelling "Wolverines." I mean, you don't remember the very end where they slink away in the snow.
Right. Right. Or all that hate's going to burn you up. Keeps me warm. Yeah.
In Rocky IV, what do you remember? You remember that Ivan Drago kills Apollo Creed. I mean, you sort of remember the end where they come around, but even then you don't really believe it. So, you know, the message is, in 1983, War Games is a great example. And kudos to you, Peter, for remembering that. Cause in my mental Rolodex, that one doesn't pop up as much as it should. But there are other movies from the 80s that I'm probably going to answer your next question here, that were great Cold War movies, and nobody name checks them today, like The Falcon and the Snowman.
Oh,
yeah, brilliant film.
White Knights is mm-hmm. another one where, is it more of a dance movie? Is the Cold War movie? Do you have to make up your mind? Does everything have to be one genre? You could argue about Firefox. You could say Top Gun, in a way.
No Way Out. No Way Out ends up being a Cold War movie in the end. Sorry, spoilers, guys.
did you guys ever – there's a couple I was going to ask you both if you've seen Judgment in Berlin with Martin Sheen.
I don't think so.
I have not seen that.
Okay, that's a really good one, and I think it's on Prime right now, but the premise is that I think it was a Polish person had hijacked a flight going from East Berlin to Poland and forced them to land in West Berlin. And in the ensuing excitement, an East German person got shot, and there had to be a trial. And it pretty interesting film, and it apparently was based on somewhat of a true story. But there was another one. Have you seen The Experts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love that movie.
I think it might rank for a Razzie, but it's still very watchable.
I confess this with no shame whatsoever. I own that on DVD.
Really?
So yeah.
Well done.
I think I'm the only one probably. Brad, you haven't seen The Experts, have you?
I have not.
The whole idea is that the Soviet Union, in an effort to better train their spies, they basically create an American town in the middle of the Soviet Union where everyone – it's just – but it's based on like 1950s America. It's not based on current
it's
America.
It's like based on Reading People magazine. They built
right. And so they bring over these two – they bring over Ari Gross and John Travolta are these two failed club owners in the U.S. And they bring them over basically to test the citizens / spies of this town to see how well they could pass as Americans. And it's actually the movie where John Travolta meets Kelly Preston, his future wife. And it also features one of my friends, Deborah Foreman.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So it's incredible, huh? But that's a great example, Peter. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. It's an eminently watchable film, Brad. I wouldn't say it's the most profound about the period, but it's pretty funny. And just I think Steve, you'll agree, the mullets in the show are absolutely classic.
Yeah. It's a fun watch. You're not going to see it show up on cable anytime soon. You're going to have to really look for it. If you want
to seek that one out, I'll stop by sometime, Steve, and we'll watch the DVD.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, guys, I would say that probably during the 1980s, when it came to a communications medium, television really was the king. You know, it was pretty well omnipresent in everybody's lives, and TV really had a life of its own during the 1980s. I was curious from the standpoint of what you would remember, and reflecting back on the period, what would you say were probably the key elements of television that were most important about conveying what was going on with the Cold War? Was it fictional TV? Was it documentary? Was it the current events programs?
I mean, when you say TV and Cold War, I feel like, you know, my mind goes right to The Day After and things like that. You know, which were kind of event television. And again, that runs a little counter to what we were talking about in movies, where it was this convenient villain that we would use as kind of a cutout to stand up our plot. You know, that was a more of a in your face, like, look, this is going to get ugly fast. What do you think about that?
But it's interesting, Brad, because you've just sort of preempted my next question, and it was directly related to The Day After. I'm delighted that we're thinking on the same page. I can recall when that movie came out, and I was in elementary school, and it scared the living you-know-what out of me. I remember the following morning before class, it's all anybody was talking about. And it clearly didn't have just that impact on me. It impacted a lot of people who were across the United States and Canada. And if I remember rightly, ABC actually had to have counselors on the telephone for people to phone into because of how traumatic watching it might have been for them. And when you take this into account, as two individuals who were, you know, in their youth in the United States at the time, what was the feeling like stateside when this movie came out and in the ensuing aftermath?
I can tell you how it affected me. I remember it well. It's an embarrassing story. But see, 1983, I would have been just old enough where I didn't need to have a babysitter anymore. I had a younger sister, but by 83, I would have been old enough to stay home alone. And I remember that was a night when my parents went out to dinner. And so I'm home and I turn on the television set, and it's not at the beginning of the movie. It's somewhere in one of the scenes where it's a news scene and they're broadcasting news. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was real. I didn't think it was a movie at all. I lost my mind. I mean, I'm like, holy crap. Like the first or second time I'm left home alone to watch my kid sister, and now we're going to war.
Yeah, we go full worst case scenario here.
So, I mean, I called everybody I knew who I had a phone number for. I'm just like, you know, are we going to be okay? You know, it's like, where are mom and dad? I need to talk to them now. And I mean, I can still feel the panic today that was just racing through my body at the time. I don't think I could go back and watch it again. I think that would be way too traumatic for me.
I'm really glad you have a good story about that, Steve, because you're not going to believe this. I never saw it. I mean, really? I know it was, I must have been doing something else that night. I don't know. But the conversation at school the next day, as you say, it was all about that. And I remember having a fairly detailed conversation at lunch the next day with my friends. I lived in a small town about an hour west of Oklahoma City, and we were discussing the fact that Tinker Air Force Base was probably a primary target because that's where the AWACS airplanes were based. And, you know, basically discussing the merits of, well, if this starts, do you drive into Oklahoma City so that you just evaporate and you don't have to deal with it? Or do you stay here and have to try and pick up the pieces? Like, which is worse? God. Like, that's a pleasant conversation to have over your horrible cafeteria food.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Brad, for the sake of you knowing that you can still watch it, the entire thing is on YouTube.
Great.
If you want to watch it, Steve, I know you said you're not going to be watching it, but
now I know what clips to send Steve.
But I was going to say, it was interesting because I don't remember where I read it. It might have been in Reagan's diaries, but apparently it bothered him so much, he actually phoned the individual that directed it and said to him that it had quite a profound effect in terms of the direction he wanted to go. And it was at that point where he decided that he wanted to reach out to the Soviet leadership to see what could be done. So it was amazing because it was a movie that impacted people all the way from school in Oklahoma, Florida, Canada, through to the White House. And I think that really resonates in terms of the impact that a piece of visual art had during the Cold War. I'm curious, from your guys' opinion, what is it about the 80s that's generating such interest in terms of the production of television nowadays? And you'll see where this is going to go from a Cold War standpoint in a second. But what is it about the 80s that makes producers now want to bring that whole era back into contemporary television?
Years ago, there was a movie called Hot Tub Time Machine, and I had a chance to interview the director of that. Mm-hmm. And I asked him a similar question, like, why do you think the 80s have become such a fertile ground in Hollywood again? And his answer, which I had never considered before, was pretty telling. And he said, everyone who's a decision maker now in Hollywood is someone from the 80s generation. Like, we're at that. Hollywood is basically being run by people our age right now. and they're going back to the decade that they love, that they remember so well, and they're honoring it in TV and in movies.
That makes a lot of sense. It was almost like what we saw in the 1980s, where there seemed to be a resurgence of 1950s nostalgia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So there's like a 30-year gap. So I guess using that logic in the 2020s, we'll be looking at a lot of 1990s nostalgia.
Not on our podcast, Peter.
It's funny because I wouldn't have thought that the 80s nostalgia movement would have lasted this long. And that's one of the surprises. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest surprise to me as we sit here with 15 years of Stuck in the 80s is that I just didn't think there'd be interest 15 years from the moment we started. Like, these nostalgia moments don't generally last this long. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the internet has kind of helped fragment that stuff out and you can find your people. But to your point, Steve, it's strange that the broader pop culture is still in this 80s.
And I know for a fact, because there were some attempts in the last few years to start like these 90s nostalgia tours, and they didn't get very far. There wasn't the same level of interest. So I don't know that we'll see any sort of 90s resurgence anytime soon. Nobody really cares to see the Spin Doctors again.
But, you know, when we're thinking about the 1980s and some of the shows or movies that have attempted to try and recreate that 1980s Cold War feel, there's been a lot of really good attempts. You know, films such as The Lives of Others that came out of Germany was, I think, superb in that regard. You've got TV programs like Deutschland 83, Deutschland 86, or from our side of the pond, The Americans. How would you both feel that these attempts have succeeded in terms of being able to recreate not just the look and feel, but even the atmosphere of the period as you watch some of these television programs or films?
Well, of the ones you've mentioned, I've seen The Americans, and I think they did a very good job of capturing not just the look and feel and the wardrobe and the hair, but just the attitudes and the I don't know what's the word I'm looking for here. The tension there, I think they did a really good job of capturing that.
I think that's a great series. I haven't made it all the way through yet. I was kind of savoring it. I have this weird thing about TV series where I don't like to finish them because then they're over. So hence I'm like stuck still on season one of Stranger Things. And hence I'll probably never make my way completely through The Americans or Halt and Catch Fire. But and just last night I started watching Chernobyl on HBO, and I'm about 30 minutes into that one, so I can't comment too much about it. But it's HBO. I mean, they could make a miniseries about a vasectomy look pretty entertaining. So.
Well, Brad, have you seen Chernobyl yet?
I have not seen all of it. I've seen some of it. Like Steve, I'm not averse to finishing things. I just don't watch a lot of TV. I don't know, and that's one that the missus is not particularly interested in. So I have to find a time to watch it when she's not around. So,
well, I want to circle back to The Americans because, in my opinion, it might be one of the best programs that's been produced over the course of the past 10, 15 years. And to my mind, they did everything right. And I don't know if I heard it on the Stuck in the 80s podcast or another one, but somebody was mentioning that there was such attention to detail that if the family, the KGB family, the Jennings, were watching a particular show on a particular night, that the producers would actually go back and find out on ABC what would be running on a Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, for the sake of argument, and make sure that that was running on the TV with the kids watching it. That really, I think, pinpoints the level of accuracy that they were looking to try and recreate. And I think that speaks to the fact that, you know, we all are very much in agreement that that was a good testimony to the look, feel, and the atmosphere of the times. When we're thinking a little bit about, though, Chernobyl, and I realize you guys are both just getting into it and so forth, I'd be curious to get a sense from you both, because of the fact that it was obviously one of the most cataclysmic events, not just of the 1980s, but really the 20th century. HBO certainly, we know, does a great job on series and makes things look very, very interesting and very watchable. But considering the subject matter and considering the fact that there's still impacts being felt to this day from Chernobyl, what's almost pricked up the level of interest in your opinions for this topic and for this program?
Well, I think people are really curious about what happened. You remember that it happened. Absolutely. I mean, you say Chernobyl and people, they know what you're talking about. But I think that people are just hungry for a take on, like, how did that go down? And I think that at least what I've seen so far, it's hard to know how much of it is dramatization and how much of it is actually accurate to what happened. But I think it's shown in a compelling way, which is the other piece of it. It's good storytelling. But I think people are just like, they're just curious.
I remember when like I was watching the first episode, I had my phone with me and I had a couple Chernobyl history pages up and I was just kind of, they would say something and then I would scroll through it and be like, yep, that's pretty much exactly what that happened. And yep, that's pretty much right on point. I'm really impressed by that. I think some of the more interesting things that I think this was another HBO production. There was a movie called Citizen X that came out. Oh, I bet it could be as many as 20 years ago now, about a serial killer in the Soviet Union and how they were trying to track him down, but how difficult it was considering the incredible levels of bureaucracy that, were squeezing the Soviet Union and making certain things so hard to do. And I remember watching that and just being really captivated by it. And in terms of a Cold War angle, there wasn't really one, except for the fact that the FBI knew everything about the serial killer, but they couldn't, they wanted to help the Russians, but the Russians needed to ask. Well, they finally did. Like, things changed. The end of the 80s happened and the doors opened and they were able to get the information to solve the case. So we learn about a chapter of history we didn't know existed. Now, we all know Chernobyl existed, but like Brad said, that's the extent of what we knew.
Yeah, there wasn't any Twitter. There weren't people, taking pictures and sending, the internet wasn't a thing. Yeah. You didn't have any way for that information to get out.
Exactly.
You didn't even know what questions to ask.
Yeah, exactly. So, guys, summing things up, how do you feel the Cold War impacted people of the 1980s generation that grew up with it in terms of their development at the time, but even more so, how they see the world today in 2020?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
My first reaction would be, a lot of times I talk about the 80s this way. I like to say that in the 80s, we believed we could still change the world. And I like to say that today, we don't even think we can save it. So what did the Cold War have an impact on that or not? I think it gave us a thick skin, but it also gave us a sense of skepticism. But I'd like to think that there's still like this streak of courage that it gave us.
If we can stare over that abyss and step back from it, then maybe there is hope.
Okay. Well, we've had some profound discussion now. I want to throw out a few fun questions, what we call the rapid fire on Cold War conversations. And I'll throw out two or three queries to you guys. I'd love to get your personal feedback on them. Kicking off, I'd love to know, maybe starting with you, Brad, what is your favorite Cold War themed song? Do you like the best?
It's Russians by Sting. We talked a little bit about it earlier, but the lyrics are just it's farcical. I hope I hope the Russians love their children too. Of course they do. But it was such a great, it's a slap across the face, but it's a beautiful song. The Prokofiev chunk that's in it. I really like that song.
What about you, Steve?
It's going to be Two Tribes by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, but I will stipulate that it has to be the 12-inch version of the song that begins with the British announcement with the air raid sirens going off and saying, you know, when people in your family die, please set them outside for, but remember to tag them first for identification purposes. I mean, it's just dark, but you can dance to it.
That's, well, you know, that's 80s Cold War pop culture all wrapped up into one sentence. It's dark, but you can dance to it.
Okay. What about your favorite Cold War themed movie?
You know, the one,
Steve,
I quote the most is either Spies Like Us or Firefox with Clint Eastwood. I don't know if anyone remembers that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to, you know, you must think in Russian. So I can quote that movie all day long. But if you Google Firefox, all you do is you get the website for the browser.
What about you, Brad?
I really like War Games. I hadn't really considered the angle you put on at the end, that the, you know, at the ending is probably one of the most uplifting Cold War movie endings, or optimistic. But like Steve, I think the one I quote the most is Spies Like Us. Interesting. I will begin the incision here.
So, question for both of you guys. Did either of you see the film Gorky Park?
I saw part of it, I think.
I don't believe that I have.
Okay. It's kind of I think, Steve, you'll agree. If you just saw part of it, you'll agree it's a slow film. It's very deliberate. But you might remember there was a scene in Mortuary where Kurt was trying to discuss with the mortician about how somebody would have been murdered in Gorky Park. And just fast fact, the mortician was a professor at my university. Oh, wow, nice. In Saskatchewan, Henry
Wolf. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, no, a classically trained actor. And he was also part of the Time Warp crew, gosh, in the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Damn. Yeah. Never pay for a drink in that town ever again.
Exactly.
I mean, the only other thing, the last one that comes to mind when I think of kind of favorite Cold War movies is what I call the last great Cold War movie, and that's The Hunt for Red October.
Yes.
I'm so ready to grandfather that in so we can do a show on it and Stuck in the 80s, because that's a 1990 movie.
I know. Oh, just I love that movie so much. I mean, it's just ridiculous how much I love that movie.
So, guys, last question on the rapid fire. If you could produce your own movie about the Cold War, what would be about and who would star in it? Brad, do you want to start?
Oh, gosh, no. Kind of need to give me a second.
Okay, Steve, we'll give Brad a second. You pick this one up.
It's like I said earlier, I would want to pick – I want to do a movie about an actual historic event from that era that people have forgotten, mm-hmm, about. So I would need to do some research to just know what that is. But I really would want to tell a story that people were like, that really happened? This is true? And maybe it's set in Berlin. And maybe you have a story on each side of East Berlin and West Berlin, ending with the wall coming down and a tearful ending. But then you have to kind of figure out, is this a happy or sad tearful ending? So
interesting. Very.
Oh, my God. I can't follow that. I want to go first. Can I go first? No. Okay. Here's my answer. You know, I'm, as you might have noticed, I'm the one who's always joking around. So I'm going to make, I want a comedy. So I think my Cold War movie would be, there was a summit in Iceland.
Yeah.
Am I misremembering that?
There was.
So during the summit in Iceland, there are going to be American attaches and Russian attaches there's going to be some hijink shenanigans, you know, between the attaches, kind of at a lower level, that's happening kind of underneath this very serious conversation, you know, about missiles and whether we're going to blow each other up. And I have no idea how it ends up, but, you know, one of them maybe defects. I don't know.
But
maybe it turns out they actually have an American grandfather, and so they can, you know, they're eligible for citizenship. I don't know.
I think Brad's going for the hard R-rated movie here that has some scenes that we can't watch with the children around.
There might be a little gratuitous nudity. If it's an 80s kind of movie, then yeah, there's going to be some gratuitous nudity. Yeah, next time I'm at Warner Brothers, I'll pitch it.
There's further information such as photos and videos in our episode notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this show wouldn't exist without our generous Patreons, so I want to thank one and all of them for their support. You can very easily become a Patreon by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And you can also join our Facebook group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Thanks very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.